Welcome back to The Brandon White Show, where we have conversations worth listening to give you an edge to win in your business and your life. I'm your host, Brandon White. Here we go. Hey, Martin, how are you?
Hi, I'm good.
Good. How's everything going?
Good. Did a webinar this morning for a bunch of emerging manager VCs. And started the day at 6 o'clock doing a little workout, so I'm happy.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Well, for listeners, real quick, I met Martin on I don't know what people call it anymore. I call it X. I guess it was Twitter. So X, formerly known as Twitter.
I still call it Twitter. Right?
Started following Martin for a while. Martin's an experienced operator and longtime VC. He's had two IPOs, goes back to the early internet days with, I think, a technology company called LoudEye, which like brought back real memories, which we can talk about, Martin. And then was at Ignition Partners up in Seattle for a long time, operated a few other companies, and then is with Incisive Ventures, which is a venture fund that does seed and pre-seed level investments. And somehow we got to talking. We had a conversation on Zoom, and I was like, you know, you should come on the podcast. We should talk about this. And then here we are. So thanks a lot for joining.
Thanks for having me.
One thing that I don't think listeners know is that I usually, for all guests, put what title they want. And when I was making the video to send to you for the pre-show, I had an idea and I had this whole thing on my notebook. And then I read your thing and it said how to lose $5 million and still win. And I said, well, we'll just roll with that. So why don't we just jump right into that, Martin?
Well, it wasn't $5
million. I mean, $500 million, right?
$500 million.
That's my fault. Sorry. How to lose $500 million and still win.
Yeah. That was my experience from the dot-com bubble. What I say about bubbles is it's better to be inside them than outside of them. And my first company that I took public, when I left Microsoft and started a company called LoudEye Technologies, which was in the streaming media services business. We were converting legacy media, so CD-ROMs and things like that, into digital media for the beginning of MP3 and streaming and all of that stuff. It was a really interesting, fast-growing business. Basically started it with two guys, and then 3 years later, we took it public. It was, in fact, the last company to go public in the dot-com boom. We went public on March 17th of 2000. The peak of the NASDAQ was March 21st. It's better to be before the peak than after the peak. We raised $120 million in our IPO. The thing was priced at, the range was 12 to 15. It priced at 16. The first trade was at 48. The company was worth $2 billion with $10 million in revenue. Very much a bubble valuation. At the IPO, because I had invested in every round as the CEO, I owned about 30% of the company. So my share was worth over $500 million. And the Wall Street Journal actually published my net worth from that on that day. And the funny thing is that a lot of entrepreneurs think the IPO is the end. You don't have that money. That is locked up, subject to trading restrictions and windows and blah, 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 blah. So don't worry about me. I was able to get plenty of money. But basically over the next year, as everyone knows, the NASDAQ went to shit and pretty much every dot-com company lost 90, 95% of their value. And the value of LoudEye went down in the next year and a half the same, about 98%. So that phantom money, which wasn't really real, appeared and disappeared within a 18-month period of time on my balance sheet. Now, luckily, you know, I have friends that were in that same experience. One guy was the COO of a e-commerce software company. When his company went public, he had $100 million of stock on his balance sheet. He immediately went to Goldman Sachs, took out a margin loan for $20 million against $100 million. 9 months later, it bought a giant mansion in Miami Beach. 9 months later, they foreclosed on everything and he lost it all. So the people that change their lifestyle based on phantom amounts of money did not turn out well in the dot-com boom. I never changed my lifestyle. I didn't buy a new house. I didn't buy a new car. I didn't change anything. I'm not exactly Warren Buffett, you know, living in the same $50,000 house, but I've always sort of just lived my life separate from any number on my balance sheet. That's how you survive a giant swing like that as an entrepreneur, either positive or negative, is to live under your means, whatever those means are, and ignore the balance sheet.
Well, I lived it with you, and I didn't have $500 million, but had a lot, but I stayed in our $108,000, 1,400 square foot house, and bought the company back from investors, and it turned out well, because now I got a house on the ocean overlooking the Pacific, which still is expensive, but didn't break the bank. So I think that's right. One of the things that you like on the internet these days, Martin, and I'm not really sure, quite candidly, a lot of these younger people think that this is like something new, but I think the conversations have been going on. I started in 1996 on the internet, and I think that's about, I think your LoudEye was originally called encoding.com or something, wasn't it?
It was encoding.com before LoudEye.
And I remember that because there was this whole wave to try to unify a standard, which pretty much YouTube, I guess, got there eventually. And what's his name from the Dallas Mavericks? Reel, right?
Mark Cuban.
Yeah. He did Reel or Audio. I forget.
Mark Cuban did broadcast.com.
And
sold it to Yahoo, and then block traded all of his Yahoo shares in one day, the day the lockup came off, and put $4 billion in his pocket, which was a very smart move.
Yeah, like no brainer, right? Yeah. But there was this movement to have a centralized encoding for audio and video, because I was quote unquote podcasting back then, which was put a file on a flat HTML page so I didn't have to write phishing reports by hand. But it was a wild time. And I think the thing that most people don't understand is that, yeah, I mean, you see them on X all beating up Elon Musk, like, oh, he has billions of dollars. It doesn't mean you're liquid, not to mention your tax bill, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, he ran into that problem, right? I mean, he had to sell a whole bunch of shares for the tax. And Elizabeth Warren complained about Elon Musk's things. And he's like, listen, I paid the most taxes of any American ever. I don't not pay taxes. But this whole idea that the idea of a wealth tax on assets that may not be liquid is the worst idea ever. It's been tried in other countries and it never works just because it forces liquidity. It's very similar to estate taxes and some of these death taxes that cause problems. Somebody dies and then the next generation is stuck with a 35% tax bill, and then they have to liquidate some assets, which are many times not very liquid, the family house or whatever, and it causes a real problem. It's on steroids for startup founders, because even though I had all that number on the balance sheet, CEO, if you're still a CEO of a company, you're unable to trade the stock except for very short windows around earnings times. You have to disclose, you have to pre-file a plan. It's a whole process. It's very, very hard.
What do you think about the movement, and does it still happen right now that you see founders have started to take money off the table in early rounds of funding? I don't want to say the company name because I know the guy here in San Francisco that handled it, but it's a big company that everyone knows that is a cloud-based company that may or may not store documents. But that person made most of his money not when it went public, but basically taking money off of each round. How do you view that?
I have a couple of portfolio companies who have done that, and I don't have any problem with it if it is a immaterial amount and it has a specific reason. So for example, one company that happened for, the CEO sold some shares in the Series A. But the reason he sold shares in the Series A is that the company had been going for 5 years. It had been recapitalized once already. And so he had been at it for 5 years, making under $100,000 a year. And so he had, with his wife, a real cash and credibility problem. So he took a couple million dollars out of a $25 million round. I did not think that was material. I thought it was completely appropriate. a second company that did in my portfolio that did it, they were raising a Series B and the investor wanted to put $40 million in. But the company didn't want to sell that many shares in terms of dilution, but the investor still had an ownership target and the board didn't want to sell that many. So what they ended up doing was buying some common shares from the founders as a way to help that investor meet their ownership target. So it wasn't the CEO wanted to sell, it was the investor had an ownership target. And in that case, I think it's completely fine too. Where I think it crosses the line and gets to be problematic is people like Andrew Newman at WeWork. He got $1 billion buyout from SoftBank when the company ended up going bankrupt. That is not very appropriate. And I have seen CEOs in some companies use their leverage with investors to get payouts in companies that are not doing that well. I think that's all inappropriate. But obviously, it happens. And if you have a willing buyer and a seller, like you had in SoftBank's case, there's nothing illegal about it. I personally, as an investor, would rather see the founders keep as much money in there as possible. But I also realize that as companies stay private longer, the liquidity happens longer. And I have those personal needs for cash flow too. Generally, executives and companies underpay themselves on a W-2 basis. So I don't have a problem with them taking off some. Obviously, I'd rather it be a little bit later, like in the C or B than the A. But I've seen it both ways. And as long as it's a reasonable amount for a good reason, I don't have any problem with it.
How do you feel about founders paying themselves once they actually have a round? There's someone like Peter Thiel who says if he sees a CEO over 150,000, and I don't know if this is still his mantra, but it was for a very long time, that was too much. There's comps out there that, as for listeners, and obviously Martin knows, that publish by stage what each C-level person and even VP of sales would get inside and outside the company. But how do you feel about that?
As an investor, I would prefer that my management was incented the same way as I am with equity, with primarily equity. That doesn't mean it's hardship. Personally, when I was CEO, I did exactly what Peter Thiel said. I never paid myself more than $150,000, but I also had 20, 30, 40% of the company. So I had as much or more, I had more than most of my investors did. I think that's aligns people correctly. At the same time, I think we're in a point where there's less competition from big tech, unless you're an AI company. I mean, technical people in AI can get paid $1 million or $2 million a year from OpenAI today. If you're in one of those hyper competitive categories, I think you have to pay a market rate and equity. But for everybody else, I think I prefer the 60, 70% of W-2 and a higher equity percent. I think it just aligns in incentives correctly.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Now, when we talk about the equity, and many times founders don't realize this, and I don't know what your deals look like, I see a lot of deals. My investments tend to be smaller angel deals, so I see things as they work up through the process. But back when I was a founder and of companies that were venture funded, in many times I had to give my equity back and vest it. And in those cases, there could be an argument, if I put on my founder hat, and I know you're one too, to say, yeah, I have my equity. I have a large amount of equity, whatever that may be, 30 or 40%, depending on how many founders you had and all the rounds and all that sort of stuff. But you're asking me to give it back. And yeah, I'm going to stay, but I still don't necessarily have it. And it's subject to dilution, of which once you're on the rocket ship ride, I mean, you get to a B round and you get that B round funded. There's something there, usually, quote unquote, that's happening. And then you would say, hey, I need to have more money. But as it relates, do you see founders having to give back their equity and reinvest it?
And that is completely normal. Yes. I'm a pre-seed investor, and pre-seed is typically done as a safe round. So the cap table is what it is. Usually it's almost all owned by the founders and common and stuff like that. what ends up this kind of vesting and having different share classes ends up happening in the first round that is priced by an outside investor and you create preferred shares. That used to be until last year, like the A was when rounds were being priced. In the last year, I'm seeing people pricing seed rounds now, which I actually prefer. I think the sooner you price a round, the better. But typically when you price a round, you have to figure out the size of the option pool and you put founders on a vesting schedule. Then it's completely reasonable for founders to negotiate that vesting schedule. Normal, and it depends on how long they have been at it prior to that funding round. If you're a founder and you've been bootstrapping and pre-seeding for 3 or 4 years before you raised a priced round, having a shorter revesting schedule of like 2 years makes sense to me. If you are 6 months into it and you're pricing your round, having, you know, more like a regular 3 or 4 year vesting schedule makes more sense. But that's something that founders should think about, is how long have they been at it and what is a reasonable revest? It is reasonable to revest because basically the new investor who's writing a big check, if you're raising a seed round, you probably have a lead putting in a $2 or $3 million check. If you're raising an A round, you have a lead putting in a $5, $7, $10 million check. That's a material check. That person needs to understand the team he's investing in is going to be in the seats for at least 2 or 3 years to get a return on his investment. So having an earnout is not unreasonable. It is possible for CEOs and founding teams to negotiate the time of that based on how much they've already put in.
This episode is sponsored by the Halle Financial Team at Expert Lending. Buying a house in today's market is competitive, and you need a lender that can close fast and get you the very best rate. The team is licensed in 48 states and has over 20 years experience in the real estate and lending space, and access to lending rates that most mortgage brokers can't get. I know, because I'm an investor in the team. If you need a mortgage or know someone that does, call or text Kara at 571-271-9086 and talk to a real human who will give you the customer service you deserve. Again, call or text Kara at 571-271-9086. Now back to the show. So I'm going to throw this out there for discussion because my initial reaction here seems to be at this very moment this morning from a founder perspective, because I am a founder of a SaaS company. But one of the things, and I think as you, well, as you get older, you get a lot smarter. And certainly after your first one, you do. So when, if I were in those shoes, I would want at least, depending, like if it's 6 months or 3 months, I think that's completely reasonable. Like, hey, listen, new, you haven't been killing yourself. This is going to be legit. You're going to vest, because you and I and everyone else knows that a lot of things go wrong in the early years. And some people just say, I don't want to do it anymore and leave. Yeah. But you can't give them equity. I already have made that mistake. You can't see the scar on my back, but it's deep and long. But I worry about tax consequences. Now, I know that could be putting the cart before the horse. However, it is material, because if you get your shares and it's under $50 million in value and you vest those shares for 5 years, you get increments of $10 million effectively tax-free because of that. The I forget exactly what it's called, but it's the small business owner.
USPS.
Yep. So how do you feel about, I'm just putting that there for discussion, mainly because as I'm listening to you, I'm like, oh, I got to say something as a founder. How do you feel about that and protecting that for founders?
Well, as a founder, I don't really and even as an investor, I don't usually optimize around QSBS and things like that. Those are all high class problems to have if you get through the first couple of years. I don't spend a lot of time thinking about the 5 year out tax consequences, because if we don't make it over the next 18 months, the company doesn't make it. So I frankly don't spend a lot of time thinking about that. And I mean, if I did spend a lot of time about that, like for example, I would probably not do safe notes. I would probably only do priced rounds, because priced rounds start the clock on QSBS, but a safe round doesn't start the clock on QSBS. if I cared more about QSBS than getting in a great company, I would probably do that. But that would cause me to do, in my opinion, bad decisions and bad behavior. I want to get in the best companies with the best management team that I can. And the details around QSBS, non-QSBS, taxable time, vesting schedules, this is all mice nuts, frankly, versus how big is the opportunity and can the company grow 10x in the next 12 months? I'd much rather be in a company on slightly less favorable terms that grew 10x than optimize for terms if they're not growing.
I think that's completely fair. And you are right. You're one of the more fair investors that I've heard, because some investors wouldn't necessarily say that. But I think I became more sensitive to that, Martin. Well, one is I'm originally from Maryland, which is not a low tax state. In California, if you are not doing every possible thing legally to maximize your tax position, you are giving a lot away for no good.
Oh, absolutely. California is terrible.
I have my Puerto Rico papers filed just in case anything ever comes, just simply because that could make sense at some point for some reason. But I did want to, and I appreciate you sharing the thoughts on the QSBS, because I think that's completely right. And probably not everyone should be thinking about that, maybe down the line. But the average startup, from your experience, would you agree that you really, I mean, some of them take off from the ground up. If you have some magical distribution thing, which if you don't have that in today's day and world, I think you're in big trouble, because you're going to get on the crack and have to do Facebook ads and Google ads. And that generally doesn't go well for the most part. But how long do you think people should, in the current stage, think about doing a startup? Because there seems to be, at least on X, a community of founders who have been corrupted somehow to thinking that there's these overnight successes that happen. And it, in my experience over two decades, just generally isn't like that.
Yeah. It's funny. I just saw something about a post about Procore, which is a construction software, vertical market software company. It's like the darling right now of construction. And it's been called an overnight success. They started 18 years ago, and it took them 10 years to get to $5 million in revenue. 10 years. And now they're at like a couple hundred million, but these things take longer than most people think. So I have two opinions of that. One is, and it depends on the kind of application that you're doing. Is it a B2B software? Is it consumer? Is it whatever? Consumer apps should hopefully be a lot more viral and be able to grow faster than B2B apps. That's for sure. But I actually like two frameworks. One is I'm a pre-seed investor. And so I tend to invest after somebody has an MVP, they have a first couple customers, but what they're trying to do is get it out to the next 20, 30, 50 B2B customers and prove a little more product market fit. I want to give that company 18 to 24 months of runway, because I think it's going to take that long to test some different marketing channels, go to markets, trade shows, all these different things, and figure out which marketing channels work and how to scale them. So I recommend pre-seed founders raise more money than they think. I don't recommend people raise 6 months worth of money, because you're not going to be able to answer any material business questions in 6 months. That being said, when you go back into the product side of things and develop things, I think you need a much shorter window in terms of figuring out if your initial MVP has product market fit. And I recommend that you try to figure that out in like 3 months. So if you cannot come up, if you cannot interview, I think I wrote a tweet about this. I think the product market fit hack is basically talk to 100 customers about your potential thing that you want to build. If you get more than 40% of them saying, yes, I would like to see something like that, then build something, but build it in like a month. or 2 months, whatever you can build in a month or 2 months, and then start trying to sell it going back to those 40%. And see if 40% of the, and then sell it to 5 or 10 people, and then do a survey of those people and see if 40% of them say that they cannot, would, their life would be unhappy without that product. That's the standard test of product market fit. You should be able to do all of that within 3 or 4 months. If you can't interview 100 customers, develop something, and ship it to the first 5 or 10 customers within 4 months, if that's going to take you 2 years, that's too long. You should be able to ship an MVP in less than 4 months and get it in the hands of customers with material feedback. Do not spend a year developing your product before you engage with customers.
Yeah, it's I learned that same thing, and I passed on that type of advice, and people say to me, I actually tell them they need to talk to 100 people in a week, and they're like, oh, I'll never do that.
It's possible.
Yeah, my question is what else are you doing all week? I mean,
exactly.
Do you care? So I think that's great advice. Some of the stuff, and we did that, we hacked together a thing that required a security audit, and we just didn't do the security audit before. And I just prefaced, I walked every single person through, and I'm only saying this for listeners out there who are going to throw that thing out there, right? A lot of apps now, if you actually hook up to some other major thing, like if you hook up to Google, whatever you want to hook up to Google, you got to go through a security audit. It's not quite a SOC 2 audit, but
sure,
it's pretty extensive, but we just hacked our ways around it. And then I just walked people through and said, look, there's a warning. I promise you it's safe. I'm going to delete all this afterwards. I just need your feedback to see what happens, and you can put it together. But I think entrepreneurs in general, even as much as we take risks in general, just so scared to get this negative feedback about this idea that swirled around our head for 6 months or 5 years in some cases, right?
That's why I only invest in companies that have customers. Because until you have engaged with customers, even if you just talked to 100 customers and got some product ideas, or you dreamed up some product in your head that you think people might buy, until you've engaged with customers and gotten real customer feedback and built a list of feature requests and upgrades and stuff like that, you have no idea how much you have to work on your original idea to get to somewhere that is going to be a real saleable product. Until you engage with the enemy or the customer, you don't know. And that's why I tend to not invest a lot in ideation phase, where people have a PowerPoint presentation and they say, I think I want to build this thing for this big market. Because until you engage with customers and get real feedback, I actually just posted something on Twitter earlier. This guy wrote an interesting blog post about vertical versus horizontal market software, and pointing out that there are these ghost markets on either end of that. Markets that seem like a market that are not really a market, where people say, I would love this kind of thing, and if you built it, blah, blah, blah. But then, and you build it, and then people are like, well, actually, what I really wanted was this one other little thing. And they nickel and dime you to death, and they never actually pay.
I read that article because you had posted it, I think, on your website, right? It was, and then, yeah. And a link to it. And I went to it, yeah, and read it. I read it twice because I didn't, the first time, I think Matt Brown, where's Matt Brown from?
Matt, he's a VC.
Okay. And it was really interesting. And I think what I took away from that to try to create a framework to be able to apply to things was, it really needs to be a core problem. I think in that example, he gave Calendly as one, and on one side, which is more horizontal, but they did go into a vertical to start. And then there was another example on the other side. I can't remember right now, but
yeah,
quite interesting to basically validate that. The other thing, Martin, that's really interesting, and look, I'm raising my hand because I'm guilty of it sometimes. I just brute force myself to put it out in the public. But once you get the users, they actually design your Jira board for you, because sure, they just tell you that. And then you just build what the majority want. And you talked about this in an article too. I learned the lesson the hard way, because I made clothing once, and all the people who were bigger told me that if I made XXXXL or whatever shirts, they would buy like 50 of them and blah, blah, blah. And then I made them all, and nobody bought them. They're like, eh, right? So the same thing can happen if you don't actually get that thing out in the market. But once it's out in the market, they basically are just going to tell you, and then you can just down select in some, you could even do a regression analysis if there was a think feedback and figure out what to build.
You need to get that feedback loop going with your customers, because that'll let you build something that they're more likely to pay for. Yeah.
I want to switch gears here for a second, because you did an excellent article on your website around the new, I call it the new, at least for me, the last time I raised any sort of venture, large venture money, was this new stages of raising money. So now it appears that it goes something like friends and family, pre-seed, seed, maybe there's another seed, series A, and then it sort of runs out. How did this happen?
Well, the primary thing that happened, so when I've been doing venture investing for 25, almost 30 years. And when I was at Ignition, we led the series A of DocuSign. The series A of DocuSign was 4-on-7. That was a series A in 2003. And that used to be what series A's were. Series A used to be the first round anybody did. But what happened from 2003 to 2023 is the amount of capital in venture capital went up like 100x. And when you have a whole bunch more capital and a whole bunch more firms, so at that time in 2003 in Seattle, there were basically 5 venture capital firms. In Seattle today, there are 40 venture capital firms. So venture capital firms have exploded in terms of capital, amount of capital, number of firms, and then also in strategies. There are now firms that are smaller firms like mine that specialize in the early rounds. There are multi-stage firms. There are traditional, there are series A. So your people with different fund sizes focus on different parts of the cap table. So you've got funds that have a certain check size that they have to do. But there are people with smaller check sizes and larger check sizes now. I mean, some of the growth guys that I know, like they're like, my smallest check is 50 million. So they're like a Series C type guy. So there are more specialized firms at each point in the round and more capital. So what has happened then is that there are, prior to the Series A, at least 3 rounds, sometimes 4 or 5, because there could be a pre-seed plus or a seed plus. Basically, if you don't get far enough with the round to get, each stage has some pretty clear KPIs. And on my blog post that you mentioned, I said what I have been seeing in today's market, but these numbers change over time. I define friends and family as the ideation phase. When you've got an idea, you've not written any code yet, and you're trying to raise a couple hundred grand to write the first version of the MVP. That's friends and family angel. Pre-seed is you've got an MVP, you've engaged with some customers, you've got a little bit of traction, and you're really trying to get to $400,000 or $500,000 of ARR. And that's pre-seed. You're raising generally 500,000 to 1.5 million. Seed stage is starting to happen from firms that have $100 million or more venture capital funds. They're looking to write $2 or $3 million checks to get 20% of a company. $2 million check, 20%, that's a $10 million valuation. So they want to see $400,000 or $500,000 of ARR before they're going to, you know, write a seed type round. And series A's are happening when you've gotten to $2 million of ARR. Last year, the seed and series A traction metrics were roughly half, but the traction metrics have gone up as capital has gotten more scarce. Investors are being a little more picky. And as a professional investor or as a CEO, paying attention to what traction metrics each level requires is very important, because the metrics move over time based on risk reward ratios. And, you know, series A's are happening at $2 million of ARR. Series B's are happening at $10 million of ARR. And series C's are happening around 25 or 30 million. That's what I'm seeing in the market now. And those numbers are up in terms of traction, approximately 100% from last year.
It's interesting I thought I saw a chart that there's still an enormous amount of dry powder out there. Is it simply, it's not a capital issue. Is it a risk-taking issue?
It's a risk-taking issue, and it's mostly, I think it's going to be resolved hopefully in the second half of 2024, because it's all around what the public market is. And basically, the IPO window has been closed. You had Instagram or Instacart go public and one or two others, but you haven't had, I mean, there are 1,400 unicorns, probably 1,200 of them are not unicorns anymore, all waiting to go public. Until basically Stripe goes public, I don't think we'll know whether the IPO window is open. But because the IPO window is approximately closed, and you look at the public market comps, if you look at, example, the area I invest in, which is B2B software companies, the average public market comp is 5x revenue. 5x revenue. So if you were doing a Series A on $2 million ARR, the public company would be trading at $10 million of valuation, okay? So this is the problem with the market, is that CEOs are not going to want a $10 million valuation for a $2 million ARR company. They're going to want $20, $30 million valuation. And the investors look at that and go, okay, I'm overpaying relative to the public market comp, but my hope is this thing grows faster and grows into it. But the problem is the terminal value of this thing is at a discount to what I'm being asked to pay today. And that's what's slowing the deployment of capital down in the private markets. When private markets have to pay a premium to the public markets, they get skittish. Because at the end of the day, if the thing goes public, it's going to be valued against the public market comps, right? And so that's what's slowing the venture market down, is how much do I pay in the private market if my public markets are down this crazy amount? Right? It's really hard. I mean, there were Series A SaaS companies getting 150x revenue multiples. And now that the public's trading at five, like, nobody's getting that 150x revenue multiple anymore. The question is, what multiple should I pay in A when the public market comp is 5x? I'm seeing deals being done in the 15 to 20x revenue. If you are growing 100% or more.
A year.
Because you are growing two or three times the public market rate, and you're paying two or three times the public market comp for that, right?
And that basically, for someone listening, a founder listening, entrepreneur listening, equates to an asymmetrical return I don't think most founders quite understand the VC business completely, Martin. And I think that hurts their understanding of what is actually happening and why they are doing or do the approach that VCs have to take. I mean, VCs have bosses. They're called LPs, right?
Yeah. I mean, the entire VC business model is based on finding the outlier and getting an asymmetric return. I mean, the beautiful thing about VC is you can only lose 1x your investment. If I invest $1 million, I can lose $1 million. But I could make $100 million. And that asymmetric upside is why people are willing to invest. If you make it hard for that investor to see an asymmetric upside because they're paying 150x revenue and the public comps are 5x, it's just, the math doesn't work. Like, investors have to have a belief that they're going to be able to make a better multiple than they could get in the public. I mean, and Chamath Palihapitiya has talked a lot about this. It's the venture business is an order of magnitude harder today, with the risk-free capital rate being 5%, investors, LPs can do nothing, put their money in T-bills and make 5%. So you've got to make three or four times that in venture to adjust for the risk that you're taking. You got to make 20, 25%. And it's very hard. The amount that VCs have to make has gone up as the risk-free rate goes up.
Combined with the fact that you will have however many out of 10, 8 out of 10 go bad. Like if you actually
8 out of 10 are going to go bad no matter what you do. And yeah, I mean, the thing that investors, that a lot of CEOs don't understand, because they're all just talking about their company and how successful their company is going to be and blah, 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 blah. But every VC is always taking the short odds end of the bet. The vast majority of checks that we write are going to end up not working. We know that. And in order to compensate for that, we have to believe or see a path to significant return on every check that we write, knowing that most of the checks are not going to end up that way. It's a weird mental thing, but that's how the venture business model works. You know, I got to believe I'm going to make 100x with every check that I write, knowing that 80% of them are not going to make 100x, 85, 90%.
Yeah, it's sort of, you have to hold two thoughts simultaneously in your head and maybe not believe, you don't want to believe it, but you have to rationally understand that that is the reality. Otherwise, your VC model doesn't work.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I've heard some VCs or some investors telling me, we're not going to go for unicorns. We're going to go for singles and doubles, and we're going to try to just double our money. And I'm like, so you're a PE firm.
Yeah. And that's a Summit TA model, and they're at a much higher per deal investment deal. And that's what they can do at that stage. But to do it early, you're almost handicapping yourself, aren't you, Martin?
Well, exactly. I don't understand that early, because I understand that later in because PE is all a cash flow basis type thing. They're like, I'm going to buy these three things, put them together. The total cash flow is going to be worth more. It's all math and spreadsheets. And you can do that in PE, and you can make a 20-25% return, annual return in PE at scale. There's plenty of people that are very good at that. But the venture business is not about spreadsheets and well-known KPIs. It's about faith and taking risks that a team can develop something incredibly valuable that a lot of people want to buy, that they're going to be able to generate these high margin, fast growing businesses, which are unusual in the business world.
Yeah. And I want to talk about this in a second, because I know you're a big poker player and even played with some professionals. And I think the analogy that you've talked about is spot on and a really good one. But before we get there, I don't want to leave this topic. Because of what's happened with the public markets, like you said, and the VCs, investors, angel investors, whoever they are in these early stages, having to pay up effectively, but needing growth, what type of terms are coming in? Because that's really in general, from my experience, is how an investor will mitigate the risks of paying that much more. So I don't think a lot of founders understand what ratchets and down rounds mean as it relates to cap table, how that affects the cap table. But what type of terms are you seeing, extra terms being put in there?
I have not personally seen us move into the heavily structured term sheets. Even basically, terms in financing have moved away from the investors towards the company, with evidence by things like safes, right? Safes are an incredibly company friendly thing. It's not even a liability on the balance sheet. It's not even a debt to the company. There's no preferences. There's no nothing. There's no approvals required for them to issue more of them. It's an incredibly company friendly thing. And the vast majority of financings in pre-seed and seed still happen with safes, which are very unstructured. I have not seen any structuring happening up through the A or the B. I have heard of structuring happening in the C's and, you know, the pre-IPO, because that's basically what there is, a business there, and people are basically trying to arbitrage their return to the IPO. I have also seen that structuring destroy companies. It destroyed one of my companies. I was the CEO of Imperium Renewables. We had raised about $250 million. The last $100 million came in with like a 2x liquidation preference. And when we went to file the company to go public, the original valuation was $1.3 billion from Morgan Stanley. By the time we got through the SEC in the fall of 2008, the market cap had fallen to $800 million. And at the $800 million, that 2x preference would have wiped out the common. And it turned out where structuring screwed the management in that case. So I would caution investors or CEOs against taking any kind of ratchets or liquidation preference. I have not seen them happen in the pre-A rounds yet. If they come back, I don't think it's a good thing in general for investors or founders.
Yeah, because at the end, actually my first, and you remember this, in the late 90s, venture wasn't, I mean, it was mature, but not like it is now. I mean, we didn't have safe notes. We didn't have any of that stuff. I mean, a deal structuring $1 million at Greenberg Tririg would cost you $85,000. And
I know.
Remember those days?
Yeah, I know. And the safe has been a great thing in terms of lowering transaction costs to get financings done. But let me be clear about that. At the same time, it took away from investors a lot of the rights that they had. You have nothing in liquidation. You have no approval or disapproval of them issuing additional safe notes. You have no preferences in voting. It's problematic at scale, but it's been generally a good thing for the ecosystem.
In my experience, and I've had good and I've had really great experiences and a few bad ones, which I'm not sorry for because they taught me some lessons. But in general, in those early stages, Martin, I think, and I read something, I think it was in your blog, that if you can't do help at least in three ways or in something, you have a, if you can't help a company, then you're not going to just invest as a, basically on a capital gains perspective sort of model. And I think in the early stages, if the investor actually truly lives up to that quote unquote, air quotes for those who aren't watching, partnership, then it all works, right? But if someone just puts in their money and then disappears and it actually goes well and then they show up, I mean, anybody would ask themselves, you know, you're here now, but what happened? Yeah. And it's a tough situation because without that money, in all fairness, maybe a founder doesn't make it there. But there's something just about human relations in this too.
Yeah. I mean, I did a presentation last week to some emerging managers about the difference between being an angel and being a professional pre-seed venture capitalist. And one of the primary differences is that as an angel, you're basically buying lottery tickets and you're writing checks and you're not generally involved that much. You might be if you have a good relationship with the CEO, but you don't have management fees. You don't have a team. You have not built systems to support those companies over time. Venture capital firms, that's what they do. They're being paid management fees. They have resources to support companies over time. And that's the primary difference. And I think that founders should understand that. If they can get the money from angels, they got to realize they're going to get very little engagement many times. From professional pre-seed investors like me, our job is to continue to support them, help make them introductions on the next round, make them customer introductions. Like, I mean, I have staff and money to do that, whereas most angels don't. So I encourage CEOs to put together a syndicate of investors thinking about what each investor could potentially bring. Now, whether they bring it or not is another issue, but try to put together a group of investors that have all the different things that you might need. Somebody that can help you raise the next round. Somebody that can help you hire people. Somebody that can help you with business development, getting to your market. Somebody that can help you with product development. I mean, you should think about your investor pool as people that can help you in different areas. Now, whether they deliver that help or not is another issue. But the more you think about trying to add investors who potentially could help in areas that you need, I think the better off your cap table is going to be.
And in all fairness, I think that's a great point, Martin. In all fairness to investors, I think it's incumbent on the founder, CEO, whoever the leader is, to use their investors in that way.
Absolutely.
And not just expect it. And I think you could, that's a skill in, unto itself.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I'm surprised how many, you know, I ask every CEO what their investor update cadence is going to be. And most of them, prior to getting the money, say monthly. Most of them don't do monthly. They do quarterly or even less. The CEOs who don't communicate well, there's really an inverse correlation there. Like, the less you communicate, the less well the company does. And I think part of it is that management that isn't willing to take an honest look at the business at least once a month and communicate what's going well and what's not going well, have lower self-awareness to how the business is going. The second thing is that their stakeholders, investors, and everybody else have no opportunity to pitch in without communication, right? Now, are they going to pitch in or not? That's kind of on them. But if you're not communicating, if you're not on a monthly basis saying, here's the challenges I'm having, here's the ask, like, can you introduce me to somebody at Microsoft? Can you do that? If you're not asking your stakeholders are not going to raise their hands.
I think it would be an analogy to being married. If you don't communicate, eventually you probably will wind up getting divorced. I mean, you can live in the same house and come and go, but if you're not communicating, and you can live with some of that, I don't know, Martin, you can correct me, in the early stages, because if you have three founders who are just going nuts, actually, it might be sort of a weird thing where if you have one, two, three people, you can communicate well. When you go from maybe 3 to 7 to 10, gets in this weird spot where you're trying to still do stuff and ramp up people and you don't have as much in time. And then eventually you sort of cross this chasm. I don't know what that, I'm making this up out of my experience, like on the spot, and you might have better insight, but then you start to get some space to be able to do that. But you got to fight through it because these are your real resources. I mean, you make one phone call and somebody makes a phone call for you. That could be a customer that changes the trajectory of your whole company.
Yeah, that is a common mistake I see a lot of founders make, which is to not optimize, you know, sub-optimize their stakeholders. And they think it's just them or just their employees. There's a lot of other people that care about your success and engage as many of them as you can. Investors, customers, partners.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of resources to be leveraged that don't. I want to cover two other things and then we'll get three tips from you, Martin, just for the sake of time here today.
Perfect.
What percentage of a company can founders, and I know this is going to be tough, so we'll have to use some scenarios, but what percentage should they expect at the end? I think I see a lot of, I did a cap table thing once for somebody on X because they were talking about like making all this money. And I said, well, tell me what your company is going to look like. And I built the cap table for them and they didn't realize that they were going to be at 8% ownership at the end. And then it's like this whole shock and awe that won't happen to me. Well, it's like nothing magical happened. You just have to be able to model a cap table, which isn't, it's not rocket science, but it can be complicated, especially if you have some terms and things like that with all these rounds. So what would be your advice for founders out there? And I know if you're a single founder, we could do like single and two founders, because three founders and four founders starts to, you can do the math from that point.
Yeah. I mean, basically, companies are staying private longer, doing more financing rounds. My recommendation is basically the founders should model 75 to 85% dilution from their original stake to an exit. That's a reasonable dilution. That's three rounds of 20%.
And the bet here for those listening who may have just either fallen off their bike if they're listening or chair or something, is you're betting that you're, if you are getting a venture investment or an angel investment who is investing on angel, on venture type model, you're betting for the moon here. It's hundreds.
You're betting for the moon. Yeah. I mean, you're going to get an 75, 80% dilution, but you're going to have something that's worth hundreds of millions instead of single digit millions. And that's the whole bet. You have to really want to do that. You have to want a smaller piece of a bigger pie versus a bigger piece of a small pie. For founders that are penny wise and pound foolish, that's for founders that tell me like, I'm not taking more than 10% dilution in this round. It's like, okay, fine. You know, you're the problem is that for any priced round, a seed or a series A, every one of those investors, if you have a $100 million fund or more, you have an ownership target. And I guarantee you, your ownership target is 15 to 20%. It might be 25%. So investors, professional investors, if you go down that route, every round, the lead needs at least 20%, which means your round is likely to be a 25 or 30% dilution round. You have three 30% dilution rounds, you're at 85% dilution from your first ownership percent. So if you owned 50%, 75% dilution, you're at 15?
Yeah. 15. You're at 15 or 7.5. What is it? I haven't had any.
75% is probably a little more, 12.5.
12.
And what you're hoping is it's 12 of 100.
Right.
Which is $12 million instead of 50 of 3.
And I think it's just a good exercise for founders to do that and get their head around it so that it doesn't cause some drama down the road and realize that that's what you're signing up for. I don't think a lot.
The reality is, when I look at all the different things I've done, investing and being CEO and all that stuff, I have created more wealth as a CEO, even though I owned a minority percent, than any other activity. Because the reality is, it's usually free equity. I mean, you might have put some initial money in, but all of that, whatever it's worth, you didn't put in the money that other people did to grow that.
Yeah, it's an incredible return if you actually look at it on paper. And I understand time is money, but it's an incredible amount of money that you get. So I agree with you. I want to touch on one thing just because it's important and we sort of alluded to it earlier, is you're a big poker player.
Yeah.
And playing Texan Hold'em, and I'm a poker player, but playing Texas Hold'em is very much like being either a founder and or an investor. And you've been able to articulate that in a really cool way. So I just want to give you an opportunity to talk about that, because I think it's a good analogy for both sides of the table, founders and investors, to think about the incremental risk and that you take on every single card.
Yeah. So I recommend to all my founders the book, Thinking in Bets by Annie Duke. And Annie Duke's a professional poker player who now is kind of like a business coach. And she's explained it this way a lot too. Basically, both startup investing as an investor or as a CEO and poker are games of incomplete information that are where you are faced with multiple risk-adjusted decisions to deploy capital to get additional information that's going to change the odds, that are going to deliver you a second decision to deploy more capital. So let's look at it in poker. You've got two cards pre-flop. You have to decide whether you're going to enter the pot at all. Like, are the cards that I have good enough to play any game? And 80% of the time you're going to say no. Let's say you make the call because you think you've got a high probability starting hand. So you've deployed capital. You've made the decision that your whatever you have, your cards, your idea for a business, your deck that you saw from this entrepreneur, it's good enough to put some capital to. So you put capital down. And in poker, you get three cards. You compare those against the two cards you have in your hand. Did my odds of success improve or decrease? Did this new information that I get improve the probability of a return or decrease my probability of return? And I have a second decision to make. Do I put more capital into this thing? And generally, if my odds improve, I want to put more capital in. If my odds decline, I don't want to put more capital in. And it's the same for an investor. It's also should be the same for a CEO. CEO says, I think Facebook ads might work for this thing. I spend $1,000 on Facebook ads. what happened? Was there a positive ROI? Was there a negative ROI? Do I want to keep deploying capital against that strategy or not? Did the information that I got from deploying that capital improve or decrease the odds of success? It's the same thought process. But you're all, and you're always also thinking, the other important part about poker, which is very relative for investors, is the idea of pot odds, right? So let's say that I am considering putting in 10% of the pot to, and I have a greater than 10% chance of winning. I should always make that bet. Even if I have a 20% chance of winning, if I put 10% of the pot in, the odds are in my favor to go ahead and make that call, even though it's a low probability outcome. So for example, also related to poker, I was playing in a poker game and prior to the Trump Clinton election, and we were making side bets. And this guy said, I think there's 0% chance that Trump is going to win. And I said, zero? At the time, he was at 40%. And I said, what odds will you give me? He said, I'll give you 10 to 1. So he's giving me 10 to 1 odds on something that is a 40% chance. I am going to make that bet all day long. And that's what VCs are doing. They're making a bet which has a low probability of success. I was betting, I put $1,000 down. I was a 60-40 dog when I made the bet. But I was getting enough of a potential return to offset the lower odds that I was getting in the thing. Trump ended up winning because 40% of the time he's going to win. And I got paid 10x my money. I think it's a very good framework to look at, pot odds and paying for information that it changes your decision on the next decision point.
Well, I'm grateful for you sharing that because I think it's a great framework that if you can just apply that, you could apply this to your running your business or investing every single day, and it grounds you from emotion.
Yeah.
Because it moves you into more of an objective first principle type way of thinking versus something upset you and you don't realize that it's affecting you. So thank you for sharing that, Martin, and thanks for your time today. Sure. I always ask everybody ending, in your case, after 25 years as a founder and investor, if you only could give three pieces of advice, I call them HPTs, what would you give?
Three pieces of advice. Number one, focus on what's in your control. Don't pay attention to things that are outside your control. You only have the ability to make decisions. You can't control the weather. You can't control other people's behavior. Focus on what's in your control. The second thing is, I would say, just get going. A journey of 1,000 miles starts with a first step. I can't tell you how many people don't take that step because they're scared of the long-term thing. Just get started. And then the last piece of advice that I always give is do the hard thing first. If you've got a long list of things, pick the hardest one, do it first.
I think those are great pieces of advice for everybody listening. Where is the best place for listeners to find you?
Best place is on Twitter, Martin G. Tobias. And my website is also incisive.vc if you want to read what I say about venture capital.
And for everybody listening, I highly recommend that you tune into Martin's website. He actually spells everything out. It's almost like an encyclopedia for a founder and even an investor on there for those of you who are willing to read it. One thing's for sure, if you want to pitch Martin and you haven't read it, you're probably not going to get a good feedback. So if you want to increase your pot odds and you want to have an asymmetrical return, invest some time in reading that. Martin, thanks a lot for your time today. This was awesome.
Hi, thank you, Brandon.
Bye, everyone. Bye.